Great. Thank you very much to everyone who is watching us online. My name is Timofey Brik. I'm broadcasting from Kyiv, the capital city of Ukraine. This is day number eight of war in Ukraine, of the Russia's invasion. Even though I'm in Kyiv and I'm relatively safe, I stay here in my shower, which is my urgent shelter. This is the closest where I can go. I highly recommend to all Ukrainians and Ukrainian students who are watching us to move to their shelters and safe places. Even though I'm in Kyiv and I'm safe, we're reading news about combats and battles in other cities in Ukraine, including the city of Energodar, where nearby one of the largest nuclear power plants in Europe. And not only we Ukrainians are watching this news, the whole world is watching. So in this, sending solidarity to Ukraine. And in this solidarity, we also have a very prominent speaker today, Nassim Nicholas Taleb. We are very honored to have him as a guest speaker. I already see that we have a worldwide audience, but I'm also especially pleased that our students of Kyiv School of Economics and our alumni can listen to this lecture. Professor Taleb is a man who needs no introduction. I will say only a few words that Nassim Nicholas Taleb, he's of course the leading world intellectual. He's the author of multi-volume essay called The Incerto, which includes his famous books, The Black Swan, Fooled by Randomness, Antifragile, and Skin in the Game. He will present his lecture today. He will be speaking about 30 minutes, and then I will moderate your Q&A session. I will read your questions from comments here, but also I will be watching Facebook broadcasting, which is online right now. Professor Taleb, thank you very much. I will pass the word to you. Please, this virtual floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I'm extremely honored to be called upon. And I guess you guys have other things to do than listen to lecture. But nevertheless, life needs to continue. I spent my childhood in a civil war, so I know what it is. I know how it feels. And I know that you want to normalize as much as you can while maximizing your safety. So good luck. My heart goes with Ukraine. And I was there last summer where, I saw everybody, spoke to everybody, talked to the Zelenskys, both of them, very impressive. And here we go. I'm back, but from a back door. Incidentally, I'm boycotted. I was first among the first boycotts with the first day of invasion, a lecture I was supposed to give today in Krasnoyarsk. So Russia, it was supposed to be physical and then online. And then the minute the aggression started, said, okay, niet, kaput. Okay, so I, an honor to the Ukraine, because I really believe in people deciding their own fate. Nobody should tell you whether you're Russian or Prussian or whatever it is, you decide. So it's like a Belgian person can decide to be French or can decide to be whatever they want, okay? It's your, nobody can coerce you into an identity, particularly an archaic identity. So thank you very much and support. So this lecture, I'm going to share screen, and this lecture is going to be a little technical in the beginning, but you're going to see why. It's just one function, convexity, and then I'm going to apply it to a lot of things, including what's happening in Ukraine, or including what happens to things after shock. Let me start with introducing myself, okay? So let me introduce myself. Okay, so I'm the author, as you said, of The Incerto. I don't like to be associated with any of the members of The Incerto because they address the same problem, but they cover most of it. The best, the most known is The Black Swan on some classes of uncertainty. I had a little a bit of reverse, I would say, a curse, because so the path I followed is in reverse typically, because my origin is a trader, and actually I was even a pit trader. So my when people tell me, hey, what's your identity? I started as a trader doing mathematical stuff, but I was my own mathematician as a trader, and then I started doing this kind of stuff, so research in retirement. And the first idea that came to me when I retired from trading is the idea of fragility and anti-fragility, because once you map fragility, we're going to focus on mapping fragility. You can understand anti-fragility. I also, I mean, most of my research focuses around what I call fat tails, thick tails, fat tails, heavy tails. What happens when a certain environment is dominated by an extreme? It's a winner take all. And the two fattest tail variables you can find on planet Earth are wars and pandemics. Okay, so this is very cogent for someone in Ukraine who has witnessed both at the same time. We had probably a mild pandemic, and hopefully we'll have a mild war, but it's dominated in history. In other words, if you take a fat tail, means if you take the 100,000 technology stocks that have existed in history, you'll notice that maybe four or five represent half the total return. See, if you take the wealthiest person today in America, he or she would be wealthier, regardless of when, today, tomorrow, would be wealthier than the bottom 3 billion taken together. So that's concentration. And that concentration affects random variables and requires a certain form of analysis. So this is what I'm focusing on. We're doing research papers. Of course, got involved in pandemics because they're driven by tail events. And of course, wars. People couldn't believe that the world was not getting safer. I said, okay, of course, it's a fat tail variable. You need a much larger sample. You need 100, 200 more years to really figure out if the world has gotten safer. So when I stopped trading, I decided to have a life, as a researcher. When you trade, it's pretty much like being in war. It's too much, too tiring. So your brain doesn't work fully. You're focused on one thing. You can't do it halfway. You got to really, it absorbs you at night, during the day, everything, even weekends. So when I stopped trading to do research, the first thing that came to me, when I was looking at a coffee cup, I said, well, now I know why this coffee cup is fragile. Why is it fragile? Because it's nonlinear to shocks. So let's say Timofey, you jump 1 meter, right? You're gonna get probably stronger jumping 1 meter, okay? Okay, you do that 10 times, it's okay, you can jump 1 meter 10 times. But definitely jumping 1 meter 10 times is different from jumping 10 meters once, you agree? Okay, jump 10 meters once, it'd be like, what the Russians want you to do. I hope you're not very high in floors, because in case there is, you have to rush out. So I discovered one thing, that for the fragile, shocks bring higher and higher harm as intensity increases. So the average doesn't matter. So if I submit the coffee cup or this glass to a shock of 3, 10 times, it doesn't break. You see? One time, say at shock of 3.4, whatever, I'm just inventing, for the sake of the discussion, the Gedanken experiment. So at 3.4, it breaks. So the average doesn't count. You see, you have it when you have a threshold. And as you see here, you have a dose response, okay, where nothing happens, and a lot happens. So if you do an average of, sorry, here, 3 and 8, or 3, sorry, or you can do 2 and 6, okay? You can do 2, if you do 3, it doesn't get harmed. If you do 2 and 6, for an average of 3, it gets harmed. So you have nonlinearity coming from that. And this is necessary. Everything alive today is fragile at some point. to a certain class of shocks. And let me give you the rationale. If you're linear in harm, not linear in harm like here, but linear in harm, okay, you would, and you were harmed by one time 10 meters, the same as two times 5 meters, the same as 10 times 1 meter, okay, you would be dead. Because basically just walking around Kiev, okay, would kill you. Just a little shock, the accumulation of shocks. So we are nonlinear to harm. So the small shocks don't matter. As a matter of fact, they help you. But the big shocks harm you, okay, disproportionately. Well, this has a lot of consequences. So I started obsessing over this. And because my profession as a trader was basically this, doing working with these you know, random variables that have second order effects, and constructing packages like options on which later that have this payoff. How will this lead us to, you know, how people get better under stressor? That will come. So second order effect matter a lot without getting into the math. But so the idea to understand why averages don't matter is the distribution around the average matters a lot. In English, it's don't cross a river that is on average 4 feet deep. But translated into French, is a convex function of an average is not the average of a convex function. Okay. So that's the main idea. For example, if you smash someone with this big stone, she or he will die. But if you break it up in small pebbles, not a problem. So there are nonlinearities coming from size that we cannot ignore. So this sort of like was part of my profession as an option trader. Realizing that companies, they seem very stable under small stressors, but if they have acceleration of harm, it will show later on. So so for example, you're much more vulnerable, disproportionately vulnerable to a large deviation. Some companies, and this is what I declared as fragile. Fragile is something disproportionately nonlinear in harm, and there's practically nothing on earth that is nonlinear in harm. Okay. Everything is, I will see from medicine, is linear in harm. So, as you can see here, for example, just to have nonlinearity, you can observe it. From nonlinearity, is an elephant looks like a mouse. I mean, I don't know what you would find cuter, an elephant or a mouse. I think I prefer the elephant. The elephant is metabolically more efficient. The elephant has a heartbeat of something like 40 beats per minute. The small mouse, the Tuscan shrew, has 250 beats per minute. It's not efficient. The elephant lives 50, 60, 70 years, mice live a couple of years, 2-3 years, okay? So you would think that there'd rather be an elephant in life than a mouse. No, because if an elephant falls just a little bit, it breaks a leg, it's gone. Whereas the mouse, no. And you can see it at their legs, disproportionately. The main difference between them is that as you grow in size, you get disproportionately, you have nonlinear effect on how much larger your footprint needs to be. So I'm giving this example just to give you, if we follow the logic, the reason behind the fall of large empires, centralized large empires, because they cannot tolerate shocks as easily as small units, just like a mouse versus an elephant. And this we know from the physical attribute of the system. So that, for example, a tall tower is much more fragile than a lot of houses, okay, disproportionately more fragile, so it costs a lot more in reinforcement. And this I got as an option trader, discovering this convexity, okay. An option is something that has a strike price, and then you see this nonlinearity, there's this curve, and as an option trader, I'd rather have the market end half the time at 80, half the time at 120, rather than once on all the time at 100. And to give you an idea how this maps into medicine, you know, the lung ventilator that became publicized during COVID, it was discovered that if you supply someone 100% of, you know, whatever they need in oxygen, they end up not surviving, they have a poor survival rate. But you improve the survival rate very much by giving them half the time 80%, half the time 120% of the average they need. And that they did better. So they are, in a way, what I call convex to uncertainty. Convex to uncertainty is very simply. You'd rather have half the time less, half the time more, than 100% of the time the same amount. And if you are convex to uncertainty, you are antifragile over that span. Okay. And if you are uncertainty, randomness, variability, and if you are concave, okay, you are fragile. Okay, over that span. So by theorem, I started working on papers, and you can basically there's a cluster we call the disorder brothers. Okay. If you like one, you like them all. So if you like variability, you like stressors up to a point. Okay. If you like randomness, you like entropy, of course, and you like time. This does not like time because it doesn't like volatility. If I leave it on a table over time, eventually some event will happen that will break it. It's nonlinear to harm. So this nonlinearity is explained. I mean, I don't want to bug you too much. Incidentally, you can either get this book for free downloaded. I'll give you the link, or you can Google it. You'll find the link. Everything's for free. Or you can probably get, but don't tell my publisher, Antifragile for free somewhere if you don't let me know. But if you live in Kiev, of course. But the ideas are explained in a lot of scientific papers, and in, of course, antifragile, what I'm going to talk about. So that some things like randomness and variability. Now, this is again convex or concave. If you're convex, you like half the time 80, half the time 120, rather than all the time 100, and vice versa. And this is a great way to understand the difference, okay? That if you're convex. Conversely, I can say if you have a curve, if for say an event up 10%, you make more money in the markets, that's what an option does, then you lose if the market goes down 10%, you are convex. And if you lose 10%, you lose more at down 10%, then again, you are concave. That's basically one way to view it. In the long run, if you're convex and you don't pay for it, you're going to do very well. We'll on that later. So now let's look at medicine. Life is nothing but an S curve in medicine. Everything that has a floor is a convex from a floor. And everything that has a ceiling is concave to the ceiling. Okay, everything is an S curve in medicine, all right? Or what I call the more complicated S curve, where you may have the S curve that's green, or an S curve that goes up, like I want to have chocolate, and then but you saturate, okay. But if you keep going, you don't just saturate, you die because too much is poisonous. So this is very important because you can see here exactly the administration, why the administration of 80-120 is better when you have concavity. In, for example, for long respirators, but you can also understand intermittent fasting. Over a span, it's better to eat 0 calories 1 day and 4,000 calories the next day than 2,000, 2,000. Okay. Or at some span, all right. So, also, you can understand very well why the dose response in chemotherapy, for example. There's actually a bunch of doc. A lot of people have studied medicine in medicine, but there are a bunch of people working on dosage using the nonlinear curve. The more technical work is on associating the local nonlinearity with the response to volatility. Okay, so you have that. So why is this important? It's important to say that over some range of variation, we like stressors. But it's going to get worse. You like stressors, but hey, no, we need stressors in some situation because we are made for stressors. It's sort of looking at all these stories of evolution, but from second order effect. Instead of saying, oh, we need water, I say, no, we need this supply of water. For example, a lot of people do analysis first order effect. They say, well, the Cretan diet is good. Now, why is a Cretan diet good? Well, look, the Cretans live longer. Okay, that's very nice. And they eat fish and a lot of tarama and a lot of hummus and a lot of okay, so let's eat. No, you idiots. They eat. Okay. They have 200, they're Orthodox. I am Orthodox. I'm sure many people in Ukraine are Orthodox, and you know there's prost fasting, where they eat absolutely no animal product for 205 or 210 days a year. Okay, so they are so, and then they eat like the meat like crazy on some days. So they're infrequently fed meat, which, and we know that if you constantly have a stressor of having meat all the time without resting, you don't do as well having meat occasionally. Okay, you don't even need the same quantities. That's sort of like this nonlinearity that we're exploring in medicine, particularly in oncology. But also, you can apply it to nutrition, to a lot of things. How diabetes comes more the result of constant feeding, and basically you don't experience hunger. Hunger has some effect. The Soviet Union had in its day a lot of research on fasting, where they put someone in a Siberian Lake Baikal, I think, and some institute, they stopped feeding him for 40 days, just give him water. On water fast. So they studied these, but all these fall into this framework of analysis of finding local nonlinearities, whether you like intermittence or you like constancy. So hence antifragile. Antifragile is basically when you like volatility over a certain period. And if you like volatility, as I said, you like the shock up to some amount. And well, the converse is if you're anti-fragile, it means that in your history you're made for that kind of shock, and you don't get it, well, you get in trouble. Okay, this is why we're made, to exercise, because our bones don't respond, and our bones and our muscles don't respond to just nutrition, or they respond to stressors. You stress your bone, it gets stronger. You stress your. This is why people go to the gym. Up to a point, of course. You don't want to stress too much, but there's the deprivation of this. If you're convex to something, it means you need it. Nature made you that way. Even for a long time, when I wrote Antifragile first, people didn't talk about heart rate variability. And I realized, I mean, in the beginning, I was wondering, why do people want steadiness? And effectively, there's a research that started to show when I wrote Antifragile that basically the best predictor of death of anyone is when your heart rate is too regular. It means you're not responding to the environment very well. And sure enough, now people use heart rate variability as an indicator of health rather than disease, whereas in the past they were trained that way. So we can look at things that require stressors and this cluster of things, that what I call the disorder brother, in two categories, on the main difference between a cat and a washing machine. So now I'll focus on the benefits of uncertainty if you read it well. And antifragile doesn't mean jump out of the window, it means jump 1 meter. Okay. So the cat, what's the difference between the cat and the washing machine? Is that the washing machine, if you give it stressors, okay, it breaks. Whereas a cat, if you stress it, it may get better up to a point. So the everything organic communicates with the environment via stressors. Like now I'm pale because I haven't seen the sun. I go in the Mediterranean sun. I will darken as protection from further sun. But I can't darken just by thinking about it, okay? We are built in a way to respond to environments. We're part of a complex ecosystem that requires this transfer of information via stressors. Whereas here, the washing machine, you stress it, it won't get better. So hence, there is a big central mistake that I've been fighting for all my life, particularly in finance, is that they think that lowering risks comes from lowering variability. No. You don't lower your risk by lowering variability. You lower the risk by lowering the tail risk, what I call for extreme events, and embracing some amount of variability that makes things better. So, which is why directed economies don't do as well as free economies, because they embrace the variability. For example, America has the highest bankruptcy rate in the world, and it's the most dynamic economy, and people rather go live in America than China or Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, okay, so or Russia, for example. So why? Because there is some kind of disorder, but there's a good disorder. We have the highest rate of bankruptcy in the world, and within America, the highest rate of bankruptcy is in the technology sector, which is the most dynamic. So you realize that making things steady doesn't work very well. Now comes to something. Basically, when I was asked to talk to Kiev about Kiev, I'm going to tell you my own experience. And this will, I hope, to Timofey and people in Kiev will understand. All my life, as a, you know, outside Lebanon, of course, I've heard about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Like people say, oh, people who witness wars have a post-traumatic stress disorder. I said, what the hell is talking about? I witness wars, and I'm certain that I got better out of it from it. Okay. Well, it turns out that there's something called post-traumatic growth. Okay, whatever doesn't break, of course, it can break you. A lot of people get traumatic stress disorder, but bad events make people grow. I mean, up to a point, of course, bad events can be, you know, something that kills you doesn't make you grow. But so there's something called post-traumatic growth, and psychologists don't talk about it. All they talk about is the disorder and the idea that then nobody's going to make any money selling you. Post-traumatic growth. They give you, because they don't have to treat you. Nature is treating you. Okay, well, psychologists make money giving you advice on your post-traumatic disorder. So they like to put disorders, and the whole attitude I have towards medicine and everything is personally anti-fragile. Is when I'm very sick, I don't go to the doctor. I go to four doctors, and if I'm mildly sick, I go to no doctor. You see, so basically, I overreact. So this is what people didn't get with COVID. I react to pandemics monstrously, but I don't react to small little deviations. So, and then of course the anti-fragile. A lot of people upregulate on the stressors. That's a post-traumatic growth. In other words, if you need stressors, you must get your stressors. So you know they're gonna be wind. There's an expression in the States, when life gives you a lemon, you make lemonade. So you try to make, you know, and of course, the only way to make lemonade is lemon. And lemon in English or in slang means a mishap. Okay. So when you have a mishap, I don't know how it translates into Ukrainian, but the idea is that you know there's going to be a lot of wind. So either you go in the basement and start crying and ask for government money, all right, or there's going to be a lot of wind. You say, oh, I'm going to make some money out of it. Big wood bills. So that's the main one. And if you look at history of civilization and countries, you see a parameter. A little bit of stressor has caused a lot of people to do very well. I think the most successful country in history, Singapore, they have no resources. So when you don't have resources, you tend to upregulate. The Phoenicians had no resources that forced them to, you know, become merchants, and one thing leads to another, so it gets you out of the lethargical states. And you look at Saudi Arabia, they have all the resources, and look what they've done with them compared to Singapore. So you realize that in history, it's good to be small for reasons of scale. As you see, scale is nonlinear, and it's also good to have no resources. So in other words, it's like Venice. You turn water into gold. You force, so you upregulate. You say a little bit of a shock makes you better. That's the idea. Just like I lift weight, I upregulate. You see, I get a stressor, I upregulate. And sometimes companies, a little bit of chaos in companies help them improve. Okay, it doesn't destroy them, help them improve. And sometimes some companies even create their own chaos. And let me tell you one thing, the best predictor of a bankruptcy of a company is steady earnings. Because it means they're not adapted to the environment. Okay, just like steady heart rate. And for an individual, if you have a steady salary, it destroys you. Okay, whereas I compared two brothers, one had was on a salary, the other one was an entrepreneur, and you see them, they're making the same amount of money, but the other one was ironically a lot more resistant. or they say fluctuatnik mergitur in Latin, fluctuate. But if you fluctuate, the more you fluctuate without sinking, the more robust you are as compared to something that's steady. And the best predictor, actually, of a hedge fund that's going to collapse is steady earnings. It means they're taking a lot of hidden risk. And of course, the American economy proved to be anti-fragile from this. And evolution, basically, is the mother of all gainers of convexity because it benefits from optionality. And let me show how this adaptation mechanism works. If you, it's simple, if you, let's say you make mistakes in. If you have parthenogenesis, in other words, you don't have a sexual reproduction, but you reproduce yourself. If you reproduce yourself exactly as you are without variation, it's not gonna do. You're not gonna do very well. The environment may change. You won't survive. If you make mistakes and you reproduce yourself into many kids, once in a while, it's sort of like a fax machine that makes a mistake. Okay. Printing mistakes or produces slightly different organisms. So if it doesn't work, so what? If it benefits, it gets better. So the best way is to make small mistakes, but not too many. Because if you reproduce with too much variation, then you won't retain the benefits of previous adaptations. So you need to have a small rate of mistake. Okay. And of course, when you have sexual reproduction, you have a lot of kids. You have variation between them. You don't want to be too far apart genetically, but you don't want to be too close. Okay, you want them to have dispersion so some would survive. So, finally, now let me talk about what my idea of black swan of high unpredictability. The way to navigate uncertainty is via what I call anti-fragile payoffs that have small downside, big upside, and how this links to this whole story. This, as we can see in front of us, is commonly known as the wheel, invented about 6,000 years ago. But look how long it took to figure out how to put. I know you guys are probably too young who are observing to remember the days when I was carrying suitcases without a wheel. And believe me, it ain't funny carrying suitcases like that. You need a trolley, you can't find a trolley. In the old days, you had to put a dollar in the machine, and the machine would never work. Okay, so the carrying this in April, this small technological thing to go from the wheel to this, okay, took 6,000 years. So you would say, okay, it's very hard to have that idea. Likewise, people built these pyramids in Central America without the wheel. You'd think so. No, they had the wheel, but they used it for toys. So our imagination is not good enough for us to figure out what's happening. But when you have a convex payoff where you have more upside than downside by tinkering, then you can approach things. So what I call the philosophical stone is as follows. I'd rather be anti-fragile than smart. So in other words, have more upside. So let's say you make an error, it costs you a dollar, okay? Or you make an error, it makes you $2, all right? So that's your convex error, okay? Half the time you lose, but you lose a little. Half the time you make, but you make bigger. So you're anti-fragile to ours. Actually, you don't even have to be right half the time. You can be maybe right 1 in 100. Okay, that's the tinkering, trial and error. And we don't have the imagination to understand the world far ahead very well. But by tinkering, we can understand what's going on. So let me stop and sort of summarize and link to the situation. You're living difficult times. I went through that, I tell you. And believe me, think of post-traumatic growth. That will cheer you up. Our war in Lebanon lasted my child, I mean, great part of my life. And, it lasted more than a decade. And it was really completely met because it was civil war in neighborhoods. And as you can see, we're familiar to that. And the bad guy, you never know who the bad guy is because things turn. Okay, So, but trying to say, okay, this is going to make me tougher on this, tougher on this. It helps a little, of course, and of course you have to fight. It upregulates things. An army that haven't seen a war like these Russians probably are not going to do very well, particularly that they don't have skin in the game fighting, in a remote place from their place of origin, populations who live there and cares about it anyway. So, but in general, I said how we can go from a concept of fragility, this is fragile, to nonlinearity, to everything nonlinear, either loves or hate volatility within that within a range, and to why we need volatility within a range. Why we go to the gym, it's the same idea. Why we need stressors once in a while, all kind of stressors. And you can generalize to many, many things, okay? But upregulating is something that people underestimate. But let me tell you one thing. I remember during the war in Lebanon, what struck me the most is that I was stuck like you. You're hiding now. Is you want normalcy, but then you read voraciously. See, because at the time there was no internet, and I hope you keep the internet, and I'm sure Musk will help to make sure it still works. But there was basically no internet my childhood, but so we had books, okay, and you create books, and it made me, it made me love literature, love books, just being stuck in that hiding and in that underground for months and months on end. Anyway, so. Thank you very much, and as you say, Slava Ukraini, and
Herren
great.
Slan. Thank you. Thank you very much for
Let
the
me stop
lecture.
and take the Q&A.
Sure. Yeah, well, thank you both and for the lecture and for your, kind words in the beginning and in the end. We have a lively chat where people usually say hello and the country they're from. And there are several questions in Q&A. And I guess I will read some. I will prioritize those that are related to, current events, and then I will read others. And there is one question which is very straightforward. There is one person, Augustine, who says that we must understand that Ukraine is fighting the enemy that has his finger on the red button. We are under the threat of getting the big shock as Putin is able to drop a nuclear bomb. So what do we do in these circumstances?
Okay,
And do you
let me let me okay let me talk about the note. Everybody's in the West is scared of the following idea. Let's think about it. He who pushes the red button in Moscow is going to be dead. So you realize what they'll be doing is suicide. So you hope, and then the other thing is it's more than one person involved in pushing that button. Okay, so you get the idea. So he who pushes that button knows, he or she knows that it's 100% suicide. Okay, so and that was the idea that prevailed, the mutually assured destruction. But now, one thing is that we know that Mr. Putin, or Vladimir Vladimirovich, is not just stable. We see it, okay? Nobody stable would make these threats. And he's threatened. Now, the other thing is they say, okay, if the NATO helps more explicitly Ukraine, okay, he will use nuclear weapons. But he's threatened over sanctions. Someone who threatens, why would he threaten over sanctions? So either he's telling you it doesn't make a difference. Okay, I'm going to use them anyway. You see, I want to commit suicide. So you got to realize that it's actually an encouragement for NATO to help more explicitly. And then I don't understand why Ukraine doesn't ask for NATO's help for Poland. Hey, bring your, just like Russia came in, you're welcome in. This is, you're my guest. Bring your soldiers and bring your tanks. You get the idea. So I don't know if he's acting very rationally there, and I don't know how Russia is built for the coup and military coup, but visibly he's sitting so far from his advisors that something's going on, okay? But also I admire, of course, Zelensky. Without him, this wouldn't have, I mean, nothing. This enthusiasm for Ukraine wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, thank you. I think the whole world now is admiring him for that. There is a question related to your lecture. So one person,
Yes.
Patrick Cleary, he asks, how can we build an anti-fragile security agreement that provides security to smaller nations, but also does not threaten?
I don't know if you should use anti-fragile here in that context. Anti-fragile, as I said, is a limited concept of things that lack variability up to a point, and don't that, so something anti-fragile in an agreement is an agreement that has adaptation with some tension on both sides that get small tensions that get neutralized rather than big tension once in a while. Okay, that would be more of a fragile. Let's call it fragile versus robust. Let's forget the anti-fragile thing. Okay. Another idea I want to talk about is that in my book Skin in the Game, which is the last installment of the Incerto, I spoke about skin in the game. How systems only work and operate well if those who create risk also take that risk. And I compared Zelensky, all right, in out there, exposed to Russian bombs, to Putin in his I don't know, bunker basement, pushing buttons and yelling at advisors who sit far away from him. So you get the idea. Putin can push any button; he's not the one dying, but Zelensky is. And in Skin in the Game, I explain why this fascinates people. The reason the Christ is loved, we're by okay, kept coming back. The Christ is man, and for us, the Orthodox Church. Particularly, not God, because God would be playing video games, right? But he really took risks and died. Okay, so he is God, but he suffered like a human. So this idea of taking risks, having skin in the game. So Christ has skin in the game, and this is why. And he was killed for his whatever he did, and that made him elevated him to a. Of course, to the idea of, to what we what happened, and the same thing happened to another Mediterranean, okay, 4 centuries earlier, Socrates. Okay, had Socrates not been put to death, I don't know if we would be talking about him. Okay, so but a lot of so these things, the idea of having skin in the game fascinates us humans. And in the past, unlike Mr. Putin sitting in his thing, and Zelensky's closer to Roman emperors, were always in battle. You see, they were generals, of course, and many were killed on a Prussian, not Prussian, on a Persian front. So this is why, I mean, what Zelensky did is vastly deeper than you can. Imagine from the outset, he did something central. Is he put his skin in the game as a leader when all other leaders on the planet don't have skin in the game?
Yeah, just like many ordinary Ukrainians as well, I think it can explain their behavior too. So I see that there is one question which appears in different forms in chats and on Facebook as well. So people are fascinated with this concept of post-traumatic growth. And even though you have already, explained it, people still ask you to repeat some key ideas of it. So what would be a combination, how to develop it? What are the key points
No,
if you want
the whole
to
point is to say that the stressor that you're gonna get is not just a stressor that is good for you, but it's something needed. You see, that it's something needed for your growth. Because I mean, we humans never had a peace in history. We always had stressors. It's not till recently that we had this post-war, quiet period.
I see. And I really want to ask one question from myself. I study Ukrainian society as a sociologist, and I know from the scholarship, from the literature, that for many years, many scholars and many pundits and journalists basically complained that Ukrainian society used to have this malfunctioning institutions. You know, government didn't work well, but at the same time, individuals collaborated. Civil society was quite strong. So you see that Ukraine has very bad hierarchy, but very good horizontal connections. And a lot of people thought that this is kind of bad because our markets don't develop well, our democracy does not develop well. However, right now, in the face of war, it seems that this is exactly what saves us. Yeah, so this is a huge disorganized horizontal connections between so many people who volunteer, help each other, fight with the enemy on the ground. So do you have any reflections on how to build a balance between, you know, building a strong, capable government, but at the same time be fluid?
Exactly, Timofey. This is exactly what I, working on. Okay, a lot of libertarians think that government is always bad, and I tell you that there's things you can't do without government. Even Hayek accepted that government should be there for wars and pandemics. Even what's his name, von Mises. You have all these anti-war people. Von Mises was in favor of the military draft against Hitler. Okay, von Mises. All right. So the way we got to look at it is in terms of what I just discussed. The government should focus on protecting society from extremes. Having a strong military, having a well-organized thing to deal with pandemics. And then the rest of the things you deal with it. Rather than the reverse. So what happens with a lot of governments is that they start nitpicking on small little things, trying to fix stuff that already works, okay? And rather than focus on big adverse events. So, but if you go back to Adam Smith, nobody is anti-government. Even von Mises himself said, I don't see government as necessary evil. I don't even see it as an evil, okay? Okay, government is government for a function, just like everything has a function. And okay, but you should not, the government should be in places where it's needed, uncontrovertibly, where it requires some kind of collective action versus individual action. There's a lot of literature on that. And what happened with under the Soviet, and it actually started with the French, trying to regulate everything that doesn't need to be regulated. And do the reverse for things that are important. But I'm seeing it now in Lebanon. You have total breakdown of government, and you have municipalities are much better at maintaining social order. So small is beautiful, and a bottom-up system built like Switzerland, for example, works beautifully. Although I would feel choked in Switzerland with too many rules. But these rules come from the bottom. They come from the community. They don't come from someone in a centralized Soviet style. Incidentally, I always keep using the term Soviet Harvard illusion. Soviet Harvard, like you can direct some things. So the government should be there to allow the functioning of markets, provide you with a very good legal system. This is where you need the government, the good legal system. And rather than regulate, allow people to sue one another. I discussed that in Skin in the Game, but I agree with you that most societies would do better in many things just in organic collaborations for some things, but not others. Yeah. You don't want the absence of government. Let me tell you what it leads to. And I saw it in Lebanon. You see it in many places. But you saw it in the United States with the mafia rule. Warlords and mafia rule. We see it even in Russia. I mean, Russia is a combination of oligarchy and and a centralized government. Sometimes they coexist. You have a mafia rule, that becomes legit in some places, an alliance with the government rather than just a pure benign democracy as of the type we have in the Anglo-Saxon world and most of Western Europe.
Yeah. I also noticed that several people, for some reason, try to push you and say something about Pinker and his ideas about, world peace and safety. Okay.
We debunked them. Pinker is not a scholar. He's a journalist. He doesn't understand the difference between statistically significant the statistically significant and the factual. So in that sense, I wouldn't pay attention to Pinker because he doesn't understand elementary statistical properties. He said, "Oh, violence has dropped. Look, we have this data set." And our response to Pinker is that it's fat tail process to claim that variance has dropped. The inter-arrival rate of wars, such as World War II, is something like 102 years on 10 years, something like that. So you can't really proclaim it based on, oh, we have evidence there's no war. Look, haven't been any war for a few years. We had a period between Napoleon and the First War where you had no wars in Europe. Okay, and then suddenly it exploded. So the problem with Pinker is methodological. So a scholar can be wrong, okay, but here it's not even a level of scholarship because if when you write a scientific paper, you have to use a methodology to say this is statistically significant. And the properties of war are such that statistically significant means a much longer period of peace.
Yes, well, this is a message also to all our students who are listening. Please use proper methodology.
Use proper methodology. Exactly. I mean, don't use thin tail process for fat tail process. Another way people use thin tail mistake for fat tail is when they say, well, Ebola or killed only two people, so therefore it's risk free compared to heart attacks. When heart attacks are thin tailed, they don't double from year to year, but pandemics can be multiplied by 100. And sure enough, we use that at the beginning of the pandemic where they said, you have higher risk of drowning in your swimming pool than dying of COVID. Well, that was at the beginning, but COVID has properties so unstable that you cannot really make an inference based on the same sample size methodology. It's not Gaussian. So that's sort of like what I focus on in this. You can download the PDF and it has cartoons in it,
Oh
right?
yeah, people in the chat already shared all the links. They have self-coordinated. I think it will be the last question because we don't want to take a lot of your time. There is also a demand in the chat. People are interested in sanctions. Can you reflect from your position whether sanctions to Russia can be treated as a stress that will make them stronger, or this is
Okay, a
something
mild
else?
sanction, like the sanction that happened last time, effectively made some sectors stronger in Russia. Like someone went to Italy, bought cows or something, started making mozzarella because they wouldn't sell mozzarella, something like that, right? So mild sanction, drastic sanction, destroy a country. Particularly that we could, a country today cannot live in autarky. You see? Globalization is there to stay, some degree of globalization, and you exclude people from financial markets. They cannot export goods. And then you have voluntary sanctions, like American companies that don't want to buy from Russia, and technology, people making chips that don't want to sell to Russia. So you end up having really crippling the place. Now, whether the average Russian whose firstborn son is enlisting in the army will understand that this is not meant, to punish you because they may react by getting angry at the West, but to make you rebel against the Kremlin, okay? I'm not sure. I mean, something got to be done, in marketing the idea to Russians that we love you, but we don't like your government. Something that was not communicated early on very well with the Iranians.
Yeah.
So, hey, we love Russians, but we hate the Kremlin. All right? Got to come with that, and we're not punishing you. We're punishing Putin, and he's punishing you. So it's Putin doing that to you, not us. So you have to also psychologically frame it in a way for people to not resent the West. But definitely, the sanctions of the type we have now definitely would be serious.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. So I think we're running out of time. The questions also start to repeat themselves. And I want to say to our viewers that please follow Kyiv School of Economics on Twitter, on Facebook. We will have more guest speakers for Solidarity. But I want to say, say a special thank you to Professor Taleb because he was
Thank
the
you very
first
much,
one.
and I pledge to come to the Ukraine when I can. I've been there many times. I was there last summer to come back and
Absolutely.
maybe you know
We will
whatever.
greet you on the streets of peaceful Kiev, and we will share food and drinks. So
Yeah,
thank you very much.
I love Kiev. I will tell you, I went there. I've been there 4 times.
Well, we will wait you more for fifth and
Great.
sixth and seventh.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Very much. Thanks.
Enjoy your day.
Have
Bye
a
bye.
Good day. Bye now.
Thank you all who joined.